This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.
Morning, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here and welcome to all of you, both those of you here in Cambridge, but also those of you who have joined us online from around the world, and we've just seen some of them, and also the special guests who will be contributing later by video conference. As Bennett said, I'm in charge of the Cambridge Assessment group, and so coming to something like this, one's always very anxious where there's a lot of technology involved, and so far, so good. I hope it will continue thus. Cambridge Assessment itself is the department of the university that's responsible for the operation of its three exam boards. That's OCR in the UK, which delivers a large range of vocational, applied and academic qualifications. And then Cambridge English Language Assessment, which provides English language qualifications for learners and teachers around the world. And Cambridge International Exams, the world's largest provider of international qualifications for 14 to 18-year-olds. Each year, our exams are taken by about 8 million candidates in 160 different countries. So international education, what it means, whether it is something distinctive, how it interacts with national systems, is a particular interest. Now, I'm very much struck by the fact that if we had tried to arrange a conference of this sort 25 years ago, I think we would have been unlikely either to find an audience or put together a programme. It's very much a reflection on how the world has changed, that should now seem strange. At that stage, international education was a specialist interest, principally of concern to a small number of expatriate parents, often the employees of large multinational companies, and the preserve of a relatively small number of generally quite long-established schools. In the UK, schools offering international education were to be found pretty much only in London or at remote locations in Scotland or Wales. And I always wonder actually whether those were chosen to make it difficult for the pupils to escape. They would offer a rather idiosyncratic curriculum, the most famous perhaps being Gordonston, where Prince Charles was educated. Gordonston was set up by Kurt Hahn, who was an exile from Nazi Germany, and was both at the same time an educational visionary, but also something of a crank. The critic T.C. Worsley, who briefly taught there, and is probably not as reliable as an observer as he came to dislike Hahn and got sacked, describes how he revealed himself as having a fierce temper, a strong hand with the cane, and a temperament which hated being crossed. Especially damaging was his dislike of being defeated at any game. Hahn was an avid tennis player, but it was an easily forgivable weakness that his opponents had to be chosen for being his inferiors, or else, if their form was unknown, instructed not to let themselves win. Now, that's obviously not the sort of thing you look for nowadays in school principals and in international schools. And indeed, in my experience visiting them, you rarely find that. But the concept of international education as it then existed was very much influenced by the post-Second World War context, and in particular the desire for reconciliation. As a result, it had a strongly internationalist agenda. I think the fact that that still exists was picked up in some of those contributions earlier. There was also a heavy emphasis on the soft curriculum and the learning experience outside the classroom, with an eye especially to social impact and encouraging good habits of personality. Again, I think traits that have persisted. In Hahn's case at Gordonston, there was also quite a lot of additional emphasis on the benefits of fresh air and exercise. And actually, I had some indirect personal experience of this when I was younger, as my brother, who was at Gordonston some 30 years ago, used to relate how they would wake up in the middle of the Scottish winter in their unheated dormitory with their condensed breath actually having formed ice crystals on the pillow, and they'd then get up and go off to their early morning cold shower. So that was a sort of different era in international education. What's actually changed since then and why? I think there are three main issues that it's worth spending a bit of time on, and they're all closely related, and those are globalisation, technology and the spread of the English language. First, however, let's have a few numbers. According to the OECD, there are nearly four times more tertiary students studying away from their home country now compared with 1990, and approximately 8% on average of tertiary students studying in OECD countries are international students. HE institutions, too, have expanded, with the number of students in higher education growing from 97 million in 1990 to 263 million in 2015. In the secondary sector, according to the ISC, there are now 12,000 international schools, which is up from 2,500 in 2000. 42% of them offering a UK and, in fact, mostly Cambridge curriculum. The numbers, therefore, are huge, and much of the growth has taken place in the last 10 or 15 years. Globalisation is clearly a key factor in this. The Paris-based Institute for Strategic Studies reports that the global middle class will grow in number from about 2 billion today to 3.2 billion by 2020 and 4.9 billion by 2030 out of a world population of 8 billion. So by 2030, more than half the world's population will be middle class, obviously rather loosely defined. This growing middle class, especially in Asia, wants the best education for its children, and that very often involves making sure that they grow up learning English and that they have the skills to allow them to pursue a career anywhere in the world. Now, national systems can be quite slow to respond to that sort of demand, constrained as they are by financial and political pressures, and the private sector has been quick to step into the gap. Some of the changes in the style of international education over recent years reflect that, especially the development of lower cost and more classroom-focused models, and there'll be a bit of an opportunity to discuss some of those developments later in the day. Technology, too, I think, is very important. We've all heard about MOOCs and how they provided a platform for students around the world to benefit from instruction by some of the best US academics and the best US institutions. We've also probably heard that no one has worked yet how to pay for them. We have ourselves successfully, in collaboration with our partners Raspberry Pi and Cambridge University Press, developed a MOOC to support our computer science GCSE. And my own sense is that this model, where MOOCs are widely distributed in secondary education and used to support the teaching of universal compulsory qualifications, is actually where MOOCs will make the long-term difference rather than in higher education. It offers a scalable and relatively inexpensive way of reaching large numbers of schools and students and of tackling systemic teacher shortages in countries where they exist. As such, it represents an attractive opportunity for international education to shed some of its elitist image and reach out to a much larger population. It can do this partly, of course, because technology itself is a universal language of its own. Technology is also supported by that other universal language, English, which is a key part of the mix. When we talk of international education, there's often an undercurrent of assumption that it is likely to be conducted in English. That is because education delivered in English has been the main driver of that growth that I was talking about over this last 15 years. And I think it would be an interesting thing over the rest of the day to discuss some of the implications of that and whether we expect that to continue in the long term. I think the growth of international education also poses some challenging ethical and policy questions that we need to consider, especially in terms of its impact on and alignment with national systems and the accountability mechanisms under which it operates. We certainly see some of that here in the UK, where a large number of schools have in effect become qualifications refugees and have started taking international qualifications as a way of insulating themselves from some of the less desirable consequences of qualification reform. But we've also seen it in other countries where the existence of international qualifications can provide a benchmark against which local systems can be measured. And again, the Egyptian contribution, I think, highlighted some of the ways in which that operate. But it's used both by government in that sense, but also very powerfully by schools and parents. And just as with PISA and TIMSS, which themselves are very powerful instruments of the globalisation of education standards, this can be controversial. It leads, I think, to entirely legitimate concerns about methodology, cultural context, and how the curriculum is determined. And I hope we can get a sense during the day from those of us involved in providing international education how we ought to respond to some of those challenges. Now, I'm very conscious that these are all rather abstract considerations, and the place where international education really defines itself is in the schools themselves and the daily transaction of learning that takes place within them. That's why we've been so keen to make sure that the experience of those schools in delivering an international education should be at the heart of today's event, so there'll be many more contributions of the sort we've just had.
This is a podcast from Cambridge Assessment. For more downloads, visit cambridgeassessment.org.uk.